When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Fails. Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered. Okay, so, sandwiched between the remastered Napoleonic episodes is this remastered talk episode, which essentially, as you might have noticed, is a lot smaller than the original. The reason for that is, well, let's put it this way, what Sean had to say was very, very interesting. What I had to say came at the end of a very long day. I still remember it, not only trying to follow Sean, but also trying to regurgitate what I remembered after a very long day. We were in Cahor at the time, we were in his caravan in Wexford, and we sat down. It was a nice warm day. We'd had a long day of activities, which is unusual in itself for me, but we were both tired. He'd done his spiel, and it was my turn to do mine, and partly because of the way this special went originally, with the one small episode, and then this talk episode, and then the two-hour-long horrendous marathon of an episode, I felt a lot of pressure to cram a lot of things in for this talk episode, and that's why I kind of forced it on. I think I even might have gotten a migraine afterwards, if I recall correctly. It was that tough to kind of, like, really soldier on through it. So rather than subject you to that, and I thought I might as well, you know, just get rid of it, because the remastered 8-parter really does a far better job than I did originally. So in line with that, I thought I'd just let Sean have his time in the sun, which is what he deserves. His story about his ancestor is fascinating. So if you've never heard this story before, have a listen in. And yes, listen to what he says. If you have not done so, research your family history, because just like Sean, you never know what you might find. Alrighty, enjoy the episode. I'll talk to you guys soon. Back on the podcast, my guest as always is Sean. Say hello, Sean.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me again.
No problem at all.
It's always a pleasure.
Oh, of course, yes. We have a good bit to get through today. Some really, really interesting stuff that
very QI.
Yeah, that I'm sure like anyone with even a remote interest in Irish history will be really, really, like really, really excited to learn about. We'll start with the Irish Rebellion thing then, because that's what I want
okay.
to.
Yeah.
I want to do that first. So
okay.
Let's set a bit of background first. Before we get into all the interesting side notes. The Irish Rebellion was basically a movement by the United Irishmen to set off a few revolutions around the country. The plan was to march on Dublin, but I'm not going to pretend that I know the names of the key battles, even though I really probably should. But they marched on Dublin, but were defeated in a series of battles. The plan, though, the original plan, was that they would be reinforced by the French, who were supposed to invade at some stage, and they actually did. They actually did in some places, but in the place that they were meant to land, I think it was off the west coast, there was meant to be the main concentration. They had something like 15,000 troops. But remember at this time that the French were very amateurish sailors and stuff, and if you can, especially in comparison to Britain, who had by far the more skill in terms of seafaring. And as well as that, pretty much everyone at the top of the French Navy had been replaced because of the revolution, so they brought in a lot of noobs to take their places.
Gotta love the noobs.
Yeah.
Don't know what they're doing, but they do it well.
Yeah, they brought in so many noobs, and these noobs didn't really have a real handle on the situation, but Napoleon wanted to destabilize Britain wherever possible, so Ireland was a pretty vulnerable aspect of Britain. So that's where he decided to strike.
Was Vinegar Hill in this rebellion?
Yes, that's the battle. That's one of the key battles that I'm thinking of. Vinegar Hill. Now, I don't remember exactly where it was.
Yeah.
But Vinegar Hill is a key battle in this that the English won.
I remember seeing pictures of cannons and rifles, and so I presumed it was in the right sort of era.
Oh, yeah, no, it is. No, that is. That's actually the battle. I was just looking at that the other day, and I completely forgot about it. So thanks. Mm. Vinegar Hill was...
What was that? That wasn't like Flight of the Earls. That wasn't two Irish armies marching to meet up with each other and getting intercepted. What was that?
I'm pretty sure that it was just... I'm not sure if it was interception. I think it was just a pitched battle as far as I know.
Yeah. With us with the high ground, and of course we couldn't do it anyway.
Well, yeah. Well, we weren't even supposed to... We weren't even supposed to engage. The plan was to be supported by the French, but the French weren't able to get nearly as much men as they were supposed to get in.
Yeah.
To be honest,
most of the Irish rebellions just blend into this one big catastrophe of battle. Like, you could literally sum it up all in one go with we got intercepted and we weren't supposed to fight and we were supposed to have allies and we all died.
Yeah.
Which would be the same in every single rebellion, so.
Yeah, I mean, well, as well, like, a little known fact is that in Connacht in 1798, I don't know the exact date, but a small amount of French troops did land. And they were able to achieve a number of successes and eventually establish the Republic of Connacht in the west of Ireland, which
it's
didn't...
It's a shame it's the worst county.
Yeah, shame they chose the worst province to do it in, but yeah. No offence, people in Connacht.
Yeah, no, we love you guys. The west is amazing. You have great nightlife, but geez.
Yeah.
Historically.
Yeah, no, it was it wasn't the best place to be.
The options were to hell or to Connacht. So,
yeah, that's the
I mean, come on.
Kind of says it all, really.
Yeah.
But they did set up the Republic of Connacht, and a few successful skirmishes. Actually, one of the key victories was in Castle Bar. Pretty big embarrassment for the British, actually, because I think his name Joseph Hult. Is the name a Wicklow guy, actually, which makes it even more interesting.
Makes way more sense as well.
Yeah.
Wicklow men.
While Joseph Hult was pretty much... He was a small-town kind of guy, but he did have control of about...
He was just a small-time guy.
Yeah. I know.
What
I
does
mean,
that even mean?
I don't know.
He's a small-time
well,
kind
like,
of guy.
Well, like, he wasn't...
I'm not that important. I'm just a rebel, you know.
Yeah, well,
small-time.
Like, I mean, in that, I mean, it's not like he's Theobald Wolfetone or anything. Like, his name isn't really...
Yeah, it's
like,
not branded on Irish rebel patriots.
Yeah, but, like, he was very important. And after he...
It's
after
really interesting.
Yeah, well, after the defeat at Vinegar Hill, he and a few other of his men, about 200 or 300 of them, retreated into the Wicklow Mountains. And they held out there for, like, the remainder of the rebellion. But while this was happening then, just to set it in context, while that was all happening back in over in Connacht, they were setting up the Republic of Connacht because of the history going back to the Pale and stuff, the concentration of British troops were strongest in the area around Leinster. So it would have taken them longer and there wouldn't have been as many British soldiers around Connacht. And it probably would have been more of a concentration in Ulster as well because of the strong Protestant... nationality there.
When was the settling? The plantations were in...
The 17th century, really, is when they look at it, because this is when the penal laws start to come in as well,
okay.
To protect the Protestants that are there. The penal laws come into full effect in 1695, and that's when...
The beginning of the end for us.
Well, that's basically when the Protestant and the landed gentry have far more rights and far more... chance to succeed in Ireland than anyone else, and they do that, the British do that, because there's so few of them. To put it in blunt terms, like, without those laws, the Pale and the areas that the Protestants had settled in would probably have gotten overrun by the numerically superior, at least, Catholic population.
Huzzah.
So,
that is a good background context
yeah.
for us to go into what was happening in France.
Yeah, so basically when we talk about the rebellion, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the one that's happening in Ireland with the United Irishmen. But what I really want to focus on right now is the interesting side story that Sean has.
Aye. Yes, it's quite a good side story, especially because it involves my family. Now, it involves my mother's side of the family, so I don't know if that still counts, but yeah. So, the O'Reillys. Jules Terence O'Reilly was his name. He was a United Irishman. He was from a wealthy family. They were tenants on land in Wicklow. And, yeah, so when the rebellion fell through Vinegar Hill, being wealthy, he didn't just get exported to a faraway nation. He was allowed leave. So he had headed off to France in after the 1798 rebellion.
Yep.
And now, I don't know the exact date, but from sometime in there, the founding of the Irish Legion, a legion of Irish men designed to go fight in Ireland as Irishmen, was founded. And Irish men who were fleeing Ireland were given officers' positions within the Irish Legion. What's very interesting is Jules Terence O'Reilly, I'm just going to call him Terence from now on, Terence was very well spoken in French. Like, and that's, you know, an educated Irishman,
it's not,
you know,
very
fighting in for rebellion. And that really shows that, you know, the educated classes of Irish really didn't want to be a part of the British at all. Like, if you've got men who can go out, get a job and have a living and own land, and they're still fighting the British, it just shows the attitude of the Irish towards it.
Yeah.
So the Irish Legion, it was set up and designed to be seen as a liberator rather than an army. So if it was a French army led by Frenchmen invading Ireland, it would be seen as an invasion, and the Irish would be equally irritated by French people trying to fight their battles.
Yeah.
And it was seen that if a bunch of Irish men came over, they would be far more willing to go join under the French banner.
Mm.
Now, it was an Irish banner. It had a harp. It was all grand. The design was to put all of the officers in place, but none of the line troopers. The line troopers were supposed to be trained by the officers when they got over to Ireland.
Mm.
So you had one battalion of soldiers, one battalion of officers, no foot soldiers. They were stationed in Brest. As far as I just learned, that's a boat building.
Yeah, works. It is.
Yeah, they were actually building boats there.
Pretty major port for France.
The Irish Legion was stationed there, and they were stationed there all the way up till 1805. With the expectance of being able to go to Ireland, liberate their land and their people. Yeah. Unfortunately, it never came through because the French superiority on the seas never happened. So it's a shame, but it would have been a really nice story if that's how it ended. Instead, it ends far more exciting. Well, I mean, far more exciting historically now. I mean, the other one would have also been exciting. This is quite interesting. QI right there. Being a well French spoken Irishman, he gets to escort this French lady to Venice or something, and he does it. And when he gets there, the general of the lady he was escorting offers him a position as aide-de-camp, which is like, you know, advisor to a general. And he's just a measly lieutenant at the time. And it's like, geez, that's quite a promotion right there.
Yeah.
Now, he turned it down because I think it was only 1804 and the opportunity to go to Ireland was still there. And he really, like, the patriot.
Yeah, well, that would appeal to him. Didn't want to go. Yeah, it would appeal to him more.
Turned down the job, went back to the Irish Legion. Now, the Irish Legion got changed to Irish Regiment at that point in 1805. I mean, I'm not 100% on the dates, but I know that they changed before 1807 because there's a major battle there.
Yeah.
So 1805, they get changed to the regiment. They scrap the idea of invading Ireland and liberating the people. The whole ethos of what they were planned to do changes. They now become a fighting regiment. So it becomes three battalions strong, each containing about 600 men, and they're allowed recruit from the Polish, German, Dutch, Danish. Basically, everyone who isn't French is allowed to join this legion.
Yeah.
So, 1st Battalion, highest concentration of Irishmen, Irish officers with foreign troops.
Yeah.
Now, the neutral language was French, but in the actual historical records, you can see that the spoken language was Irish, German, and Polish as the majority languages
in that order
oh, that's that were being spoken in the Irish regiment at this time.
Yeah.
The 2nd and 3rd battalions of the Irish regiment were sent to Spain, and the 1st battalion with the highest concentration of Irishmen was sent to Flesinga, a small town, it's a small port town on the islands running up to Antwerp,
all right.
Which is like, This is a pretty major port. So,
yeah, absolutely.
They're in the city of Flesinga. Now, this is 1807. This is the I don't know what the campaign is called for the British, but it's basically the British come with 41 ships, 40,000 troops, cannons, the like the whole army basically. Yeah. Well, it feels like the whole army. They luckily the English have an idiot for a general, so they do a ton of mistakes, which actually it helps the Irish. The battle only lasts 30 days. I think it starts in the 1st of August. That's right. The 1st of August, 1807. The Battle for Flushinga.
Oh, okay.
The British bombard the city with their boats, of course. The French units, I'm going to say French units because I'm not going to specifically point out the Irish. The French units were deployed outside the city and were holding the British from coming into the city. So it was working quite well. The skirmishes were low-key. It wasn't any major battling. 13 days in, the British finally set up their heavy artillery guns and they start bombarding the city. Now, the French, all of the French regiments,
yeah,
except for the Irish battalion, were pulled back into the city. Now, I don't know, it seems rather dodgy, you know. Are you trying to get all the Irishmen killed on purpose?
Yeah. But
the Irishmen hold their own. They survive bombardments, they survive skirmishes. They're out there for another 3 days.
Hmm.
After all the other French units have been pulled inside. Now, it wasn't like one giant pitched battle, because that would be insane if they were there for 3 days. It was lots of small skirmishes and bombardments. Now, Terence O'Reilly is in that battle. I just want to make a little side note.
Of course, because, yeah, go ahead.
There's the Captain William Lawless. Captain William Lawless, amazing name. Like, if you were going to have a captain, that's the captain you want.
He's above the law.
he had just been promoted to the... Basically, he was in charge of 1st Battalion. I don't know if that's captain or if that's general. I don't know what it is. He's basically just been promoted, but he isn't at the battlefield when he receives this promotion. So he's like, oh, no, I got to get there. So he gets a rowboat. Like a rowboat. He rows past the British blockade and gets to the Irish 1st Battalion.
Wow.
That is like just a story like in itself. I think that could be a movie and it would be amazing.
Of course. Yeah.
So 3 days later, all of the French units are pulled back and the French surrender.
Mm.
Now, all of the guns on the walls are dismounted because of the bombardment being so heavy and the actual arsenal itself nearly explodes. So, I mean, if you're a Frenchman, obviously don't blow up this city, jeez.
Yeah.
This isn't even our city. So they're like, okay, you know what? We give up. Terence and Lawless were both wounded in that battle. They were wounded and taken to be treated. So Lawless, it goes specifically into Lawless because he's a higher rank. Lawless was hit by a musket beneath his left eye. So it was lodged probably in his jaw.
Jeepers.
So, like, that's a nasty... I can only imagine something similar for Terence, because he's a lieutenant, but it doesn't describe what his actual wound was, but it is probably not severe enough. So, when the surrender is done, they're in the med tents being patched up by a doctor.
Yeah.
And the Irish 1st Battalion's rounded up. They're all sent to prisoner of war camps. Frenchmen, they're all... put together, sent to prisoner of war camps. So that was the end of the 1st Battalion. Those were the last Irishmen being in 1st Battalion. After that, the actual percentage of Irishmen in the Irish regiment was very low because we'd lost most of them in the Battle of Flushinga. Now, they'd not lost them in death, lost them to be prisoners.
Yeah.
Which is probably, you know, being treated as a prisoner might have actually have been better than being an actual Irishman living in Ireland.
Well,
the
would it though? Because, yeah. Like, I mean, if I after reading a bit about the rebellion, how when the French soldiers did land for the Republic of Connacht fiasco, when the French soldiers there eventually surrendered, they were interned, but the Irish soldiers were actually executed. So I was just wondering, do you know what happened?
They were treated as French soldiers.
They were treated...
Time.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good then. Okay.
I mean, obviously, if you're an Irishman and you know how to speak French and you're being taken away by the British, you speak French. You don't go, I'm actually Irish, by the way, if you want to treat me differently.
Yeah.
So...
that would make sense.
Yeah. So they're all gone. But Captain Lawless has the eagle of the regiment. So... That means
the standard,
the Imperial Eagle. So he still has that, which means the regiment still exists.
Yeah.
This is it. So they're away in the medical bay. They're not. They don't get picked up. They don't get rounded up.
Mm.
They spend 3 weeks on Flesinga trying to get out. They attempt to get out on a food barge the first time, and they don't get it out. The second time, they get on a food barge again, and they manage to get out. This is just like, I don't know what the British were thinking. Like, obviously, it must have been a very low-key campaign that involved 40 ships and 40,000 men.
So, just to set the scene, is the city of Flesinga, is that like surrounded by water or something?
Oh, yes. The city of Flesinga, I'll go into detail.
Okay, good,
now.
Yeah.
The city of Flesinga is low-lying. It's on an island. It's a walled city. It's surrounded by bogs. The major problem for the Irish regiment and the French regiments that were there was malaria. It was malaria. A lot of people, you know, they got really sick. Morale was low. So this battle, it wasn't going to go well for the French. Just basically from that. But its proximity to Antwerp, which was the major target for the British, if they could hold them up there, Antwerp would be fine. And that campaign actually failed. It never took Antwerp.
Ah, I see.
So, Flesinga, I mean, as far as I know, I only read that they hit that speed bump of Flesinga and then didn't go on to take Antwerp. So,
yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, the French needed the time to get people around and, you know.
Well, of course they would have.
30 days is enough time.
Of course, yeah. I mean, they were probably, this is just me guessing here, but the fact that they took so long to win the battle and to win like that part of the campaign probably saved Antwerp from the English taking it.
There were only about 3,000 soldiers in Flesinga, and the British came at them with 40 ships and 40,000 soldiers.
Wow. That sounds like a pretty big commitment to make. I mean, you don't really see, until the later parts of the campaign, of the Napoleonic Wars themselves, you don't really see the British committing that many soldiers. So they must have seen, I suppose, the fact that they wanted to go for Antwerp goes back to the loyalty they felt to the Dutch, which probably still was there.
I'm sure. I'm a little bit conflicted, because while I'm proud of my ancestor, I'm like, yes, do it. Yeah. I'm also like, you're fighting against the Dutch.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
No, but I'm okay with it, because he's a hero. Like, I'm naming my firstborn child Terence, or Jules if it's a girl, because that's both of his names are Terence and Jules. I win.
Ancestry win.
Yeah, ancestry win right there. You have a girl's and a boy's name. It's awesome. Yeah, so that was Flesinga. They managed to get back to the French lines. When they got back and they were like, hey, I'm the captain and I have the Imperial Eagle. They were like, oh my goodness, that's amazing. Napoleon heard it and was like, okay, you guys are coming to me and I'm going to give you loads of rewards. They got the Legion of Honor. They got the Legion of Honor. The highest accolade you could get in the French army. They got specifically engraved swords that they weren't actually combat swords. They were, you know, presentation swords.
Yeah.
And the banner was reworked so that it would always have Flesinga written on it. Because it was a defeat, but
it was a symbol of their spirit that they were able to hold it.
They were able to hold it. Even though it was a defeat, they were able to bring back the very eagle of like, this was like, symbolism was all important.
Yeah, of course.
If you could clutch this out of the jaw of defeat,
you're
a hero. Yeah. So, the Irish regiment gets renamed the French Foreign Legion at this point. And, well, I mean, the Irish story continues because Jules Terence O'Reilly is just an absolute hero. So, the French Foreign Legion, now it's based in Quimper. Quimper is just a little bit south of Brest, I think it is. And they're being retrained because they need to replace 1st Battalion. They need to restock the two Spanish regiments, or French Foreign Legion. Doesn't get used during the campaign of Russia. When Napoleon gets his hiney kicked and he comes running back, he has some fresh regiments still back in France itself. So he gets the French Foreign Legion up to the front. They get attacked, obviously, at the Boer River. They retreat. An Irishman manages to keep the eagle alive again, but Captain William Lawless gets shot off his horse by a cannon.
Wow.
I mean, it doesn't go into detail with Terence, but still, oh my goodness.
He doesn't survive then, presumably.
He does, actually. Yeah, he just doesn't.
A cannon hits him off his horse.
You know, friend, Irish spirits, you can't kill him. You really can't.
He just cannot be killed.
Like, musket to the face and cannonball to the leg.
Yeah.
It's just very, very impressive.
Wow.
Oh, that reminds me, there's a really small detail, tiny detail. There was a, in the changeover from Irish regiment to French Foreign Legion, there was a Spanish officer who really ticked off the Irish because he was like, you Irish men are terrible.
Paraphrasing, of course.
Yeah, obviously. obviously, it was a bit more along the lines of just a bit of lack of respect and unfair treatment.
Mm.
So the Irishmen were refusing to, you know, yield. They were refusing to bring their sword and offer it to this guy. They were like, we're not working for you. Mm. This isn't happening. So he was getting all upset. He was putting Irish men into prison and saying, oh, these men are doing this. And then Jules Terence O'Reilly fights him in a duel. Like one of those cool sword fight duels. Mm. He does that. And it's written from a biased book, but it's written that the Spanishman has to ask for a repose 3 times and Terence allows him to stand back up. So Terence O'Reilly, such a man of honor. I mean, he's like, I'm not going to strike you while you're down. I'm going to let you fight until you give up on your own accord.
Yeah.
That's a small aside. It's really cool though.
Adds to the character of the man. It does.
He's such a hero.
Yeah.
So Napoleon abdicates. When's that?
That is pretty much, I think it's 1814.
That's the end of, yeah.
So that's the end of.
So during that time, the French Foreign Legion was disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
And the officers, like, the soldiers were still around. They were enlisted into different regiments. It was 90 days, wasn't it? 90 days when he returned.
When he returned from Elba?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I'm a bit hazy on the details myself. I mean,
okay, so he's Jules Terence O'Reilly is marked as a Napoleonic officer, so he receives half pay, and the rest of the guys who are like, oh well, Napoleon was a moron anyway, they receive full pay.
While Napoleon is gone, this is
yes, okay, because they're trying to, you know, stamp out any Napoleonic favors that the people have without ruining the French army by getting rid of all its generals. So when Napoleon returns, Terence is promoted to the aide-de-camp of the 101st. Now, I have no idea what the 101st do, right? And I know the battle ends in defeat.
Yeah.
But he is aide-de-camp. His final, you know, the last place he managed to get to was advisor to a general on the 101st.
Wow.
That is, like, highly impressive for I don't know how old he was. We were thinking he was about 18 or 19 when he left Ireland.
Yeah,
for a 30 year old man of Ireland to be an aide-de-camp for the French, it's just such a like, he managed to survive and stick around where, like, men like Lawless and other men, they were wounded and taken away, but he got through the whole war.
Yeah.
Won all of these great, great accolades. Like a sword that you can actually go see in the... if you go to the National History Museum, you can actually see the sword there. You can see the engraving. It's gold enamel on black, I think it is.
Mm.
It looks really cool.
Yeah. So go and see it if you don't believe him.
Yes.
It's right
and
there.
It's right there. It'll even say Jules Terence O'Reilly, born in Wicklow. There you go. I was right.
Yeah.
I'm not making this up. So that's pretty much it. He retires. He has a French soldier's pension, and that's pretty much the end of the story. Now he stays in France. He never returns to Ireland, which is such a shame.
Yeah.
He raises a family. He does all the good things you do in your later life as a soldier.
Yes.
The family story was all over the shop. It was like. Well, first of all, Napoleon. The first story I heard was Napoleon surrendered his sword to one of our ancestors, which, like, you can see how some of the older relatives probably, you know, were a little bit pro-British and wanted, you know, nothing to do with the rebels. And
yeah,
because, like, the division Terence left, and the house was divided because it was pro and anti-British.
Of course, so, yeah, as many families in Ireland would have been. Yeah,
so the father was like, "Well, just leave it be. I'm like, they're not doing us any harm." And he was like, "No, we need to be ruling ourselves. This isn't fair." So that's the kind of, you know, the story was rewritten and passed down through the generations, so that when it reached me, it was Napoleon surrendered his sword to him. But it was really, when I researched it,
yeah,
it was Napoleon gave a sword as an honor for fighting for him.
Mm.
So, you know, completely the opposite of what I had learnt as a child.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. If you have a family story and it's like, oh yeah, this guy did this, look it up. It's probably something completely different.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
Mm.
It's really good to get into your family history.
Absolutely.
It's really good.
Mm. Okay, so thanks for joining me, Sean. This was a really, really interesting episode. I really, really liked the stuff about your family. I could literally listen to that all day.
And I could literally listen to my mum tell me parts that I'm wrong at. I mean,
She already did.
She did. She came in when, I'm sure it's edited out now, but she came in and was like, "Well, that's almost true." And I'm like, what?
Thanks, Mom.
Thanks, yeah, I appreciate that. Like, I keep going, "Oh, isn't that great that this is true?" And then she's like, "Well, no, they actually got back to me on that and it's not true." What? So, again, keep rooting out your family history, because
yes,
you may believe something now, but it doesn't mean it's true.
Mm. And I will go into, for those of you scratching your heads and wondering what the hell I was just talking about, I will go into more detail once I have actual facts in front of me.
Yeah, I mean, this was just an overview, really, just to let me say my bit.
Yeah, and then I added in, yeah, what the main thing was Sean's bit, and yeah, then the rest was just kind of filler.
It was just filler, because they're literally, it's really boring between then and like, between,
well, actually, it's probably my favorite part of the war.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the bit before actual war.
Well, yeah, because I like to see
when diplomacy fails.
When diplomacy fails.
See,
when...
I always find that the really boring part.
Really?
Yeah, I prefer the actual beating the snot out of each other.
See, when diplomacy fails when the peace of Amiens breaks down, so that's why I like it so much. But there you go. So this has been Diplomacy Fails. My name is Zach.
My name is Sean.
We shall now take our leaves. Thanks.